You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Look at the way I've been treated lately, especially by the media. No politician in history, and I say this with great surety, has been treated worse or more unfairly.
Diddums. President Trump's mood is not likely to be improved, however, by the appointment of another FBI director to investigate the ties to Russia that Trump sacked the other FBI director for investigating. My guests Linda Yu and Sebastian Borger will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Trump's giddily anticipated address to the Islamic world from Riyadh, the likelihood that any one of us might have been flown in or out of the Netherlands by royalty, and...
Today, as we face this critical election for our country, I launch my manifesto for Britain's future. A manifesto to see us through Brexit and beyond. A plan for a stronger, fairer, more prosperous Britain.
Britain's ruling Conservative Party launched their election manifesto, and it's every bit as exciting as everyone was expecting. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Linda Yu, economist and broadcaster, and Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for the Berliner Zeitung. Welcome both to the show. We will start in the United States, where all of the following hasn't just been some weird cheese dream.
Late yesterday, later matched by BuzzFeed, the New York Times, and Reuters, alleging that President Trump revealed highly classified information to the Russian foreign minister and ambassador in a face-to-face meeting last week.
Now, according to... If there was ever a time when circumstances warranted a special prosecutor, it is right now. The country is being tested in unprecedented ways. I say to all of my colleagues in the Senate, history is watching.
An explosive report comes out minutes before this show that seems to change the entire focus here in Washington. The Trump administration is denying a report first put out by the New York Times and confirmed by others now that the president asked then FBI Director James Comey to end the Bureau's investigation involving former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn.
I rise today, Mr. Speaker, to call for the impeachment of the President of the United States of America. I do it because, Mr. Speaker, there is a belief in this country that no one is above the law, and that includes the President of the United States of America.
Look at the way I've been treated lately, especially by the media. No politician in history, and I say this with great surety, has been treated worse or more unfairly.
Well, to bring us up to date, which is always a fate-tempting phrase where the presidency of Donald Trump is concerned, his own deputy attorney general has now appointed a special counsel to investigate alleged Russian interference in the United States presidential election, including possible ties between the Kremlin and Trump's campaign. It is, of course, his deputy attorney general who's had to make the decision because his attorney general has, of course, had to recuse himself from any investigations into Russia due to his links with Russia. The special counsel is former FBI director Robert Mueller, no relation, who served under both George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Linda, first of all, what does it tell us that the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, has done this? Is this the beginning of people in the White House scrambling for the lifeboats?
I think it's essentially lawyers gearing up to what could actually be quite a protracted investigation. So we should bear in mind President Clinton, of course, Bill Clinton, was impeached by the House, not by the Senate. Only one other president, Andrew Johnson, was also similarly impeached by the House, but not by the Senate. And what led up to Clinton's impeachment by the House was an extended special investigation. And at the time, That took years and literally thousands, if not millions, of man hours of looking into his obstruction of justice. And recall, this was over him lying under oath about an affair. So one of the charges given to this special investigator by the Justice Department into President Trump is also over obstruction of justice. So we shouldn't take it too lightly. And so the gearing up of the Deputy Attorney General, the clip there we heard from a House of Representative member really tell you that this is something to be taken fairly seriously.
You have, of course, hit upon there the most depressing aspect of what is, in many respects, fairly encouraging news, which is that this investigation, Sebastian, he's not going to have knocked this over by the end of next week, is he? Is it in fact possible that this may have bought Donald Trump time, that he can now keep saying, well, until all the facts are in?
Well, first of all, I think it's always important to remember that we are talking about the Washington bubble. I haven't seen any indication yet that the Trump troops, the Trump supporters are deserting the president. So unless I see signs of that...
By supporters, do you mean voters or voters, politicians around
voters,
him?
Voters, and also, of course, the people who prop him up, particularly in the Republican Party. I mean, there are a few outriders, so as far as I can see, but there is no movement towards distancing themselves from the president. All of what's happened so far, regardless of the integrity and determination of anybody called Mueller, is by the by. To be honest, this is going to, as Linda said, this is going to go on for months, if not years. And I can't see. I haven't yet seen anything which suggests to me that liberal people's dream, in both in the US and here in Europe, of seeing Trump's back within the next few weeks or months is going to happen.
Linda, that point Sebastian raises there of the dogged loyalty that still exists to Trump, at least among his supporters, why isn't that cracking? Because we heard a couple of times at the start of the show that the ridiculous clip from the commencement speech he gave yesterday to the Coast Guard Academy, in which he, a spoilt billionaire, a multiple draft dodger, stood in front of newly commissioned personnel in his nation's armed forces, volunteering to risk their lives in their country's service, and told them about how hard his life was. We've also heard today that he has tweeted that what is going on, the appointment of Robert Mueller, amounts to the single greatest witch hunt in American political history. Who is this ludicrous, self-pitying, whinging still playing with? It's a slightly leading question, I realize, there, as I phrased it.
It's interesting. On Twitter, he's been described as a snowflake. I think he's quite thin-skinned. It might be a way of putting...
That's possibly a more tactful way of putting it. Sensitive. We could describe him as sensitive.
And I think the interesting politics around this is, as Sebastian has pointed out, is that his voters are actually, for the most part, still very supportive of him, regardless of what he says, what he tweets, when he says it, on things that many of us may find inappropriate. But to them, he's delivering what he promised on the campaign trail, which is cutting regulation, cutting taxes, and all of the things they think that he's actually working on. And the other thing to point out is that both houses of Congress are controlled by Republicans. And so this is, in many ways, very different from Bill Clinton in the mid-90s, when the whole Ken Starr investigation, as I say, launched into this massive snowball where we ended up over an affair with thousands and thousands of pages about obstruction of justice. It would have to take his own party turning on him. And that does hinge on his popularity with the voters, because next year, the House of Representatives all get reelected, as well as a third of the Senate. And he proves to be as popular as he currently is. I think what we will find is that these special investigations will just continue to drag out, and as you suggested, perhaps give him time, maybe into 2020 and beyond. That's how long these things can take. And his party will stand by him, perhaps, unless who knows what might come out. But if he remains popular and at the moment, he's actually helping them in terms of their electoral prospects, not just in terms of popularity, but also fundraising. A lot of Trump supporters have given a lot of money to the Republican cause.
Can I just ask you, we've had this meeting of the president with the Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov and the Russian ambassador to Washington.
Mr. Kislyak.
Three people in the room. How does the New York Times find out that he's told them inappropriate state secrets?
I don't think it was just the three. I'm pretty sure the White House doesn't let Donald Trump talk to people without some sort of grown-up present.
All right.
But it is an interesting question, given the finite numbers of people in the room, who it is that is leaking.
I'm getting at is there must be, even in the loyal, you expect the loyal core of people around him, there must be people who systematically leak stuff to the New York Times and the Washington Post, etc.
I think his White House is full of leaks. I think there are competing
worse than
camps.
Earlier White House.
Much more so. It's almost as if he has absolutely no idea what he's doing.
I think competing camps really do exasperate that. So you still have Steve Bannon and the camp there. You have Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. You've also got General McMaster. You've got General Mattis. You've essentially got different factions. Sometimes they're aligned. But I think when you have that, you do increase the chances of a leak. But remember, we may get a tape, so that all could be clear. Well, that's not Nixonian at all.
But that said, I can recall at least within reasonably recent memory the leaking of at least one tape featuring Donald Trump that everybody assumed was going to finish him, and here we still are. Let's move along slightly.
Russian in origin.
Well, let's move along slightly, because assuming nothing else inordinately bizarre happens between now and then, Donald Trump is due to embark on his first overseas trip as president tomorrow. He will first attend a summit of Arab and Islamic leaders in Riyadh, where it is threatened Trump will give a speech addressing the Muslim world. Sebastian, what could possibly go wrong?
Well, I still remember the speech. In fact, I thought pretty good speech that President Bush Jr. gave in Cairo years ago about democracy in the Arab world. It didn't quite turn out that way.
No.
Well, I, you know, we really shouldn't make any suggestions about the future of Donald Trump anymore. But why don't we just give rise to the possibility that he might give a speech which has been written by foreign policy experts and is slightly on the sort of normal, rational side of politics?
Well, it is being trailed, Linda, as, and I quote, an inspiring yet direct speech on the need to confront radical ideology. How likely do we think the Middle East is to want to listen to Donald Trump on this, or indeed any subject?
I think the recent incident over the possible conveying of confidential information from, I think it was an Israeli source, is probably going to make the players in the Middle East a little bit wary about what they share with Trump. I think he will speak to them about probably a speech that would be very much along the lines of his foreign policy advisors, who many of them are experienced military personnel. And if he sticks to the script, I think for instance, James Mattis, who's very, very well-versed in the region, I think you could get some indication of what Trump's policy will be. But I think it's more the reaction, the receptivity of those in the Middle East to what he is going to say or how he's going to implement what he's going to say, which I think will matter. And of course, there are many in the Middle East, especially if he addresses an audience, including business, who are very irate about the ban that he's put on their flights in terms of laptops, in terms of, you know, I think it's that kind of thing that makes them, I think, probably wary that he's going to act as he says. And I think that's what the the big trait about Trump's foreign policy is that he's not predictable. So what he says may not be what you get tomorrow.
Well, Sebastian, Trump's previous disquisitions on the subject of the Arab world and the Islamic faith have not been noteworthy for their nuance. Is it more likely, therefore, that he might actually make a statement more for domestic consumption, i.e. just double down on the belligerence he has previously displayed towards the region and its inhabitants?
Well, that's really the all-important question. Either he goes with the straight down the line realpolitik that most of his foreign policy advisors, including the Secretary of State and Defense Secretary and the National Security Advisor, all purport. In other words, we prop up these regimes which they've been our allies for decades. We support them in their fight against radical Islam. We try to contain Iran. We are friends with the Saudis, whatever else they do. We are all at the same time friends with Israel, and that's how the situation will have to stay. All the idealistic stuff that Bush, for example, came out with, you can call it mistaken, whatever, but he did give people in the Middle East hope that America would support democratic movements, and look what's that done to people. So I think let's say I have some hope that is what will happen, that these people will give him a good speech and that he will actually give the speech. If given his personality, we can't be sure, of course.
Linda, attending this summit in Riyadh, on the guest list is Omar al-Bashir, president of Sudan, who is, of course, wanted for war crimes by the International Criminal Court. The United States are reported to have protested at his attendance. Would stronger action be warranted? And I'm trying not to give Trump ideas here. It has been reported that he's not enthused about making this trip at all and has been asking people to find a way to trim it from 9 days to five. But this is a serious question. Would it be a stand worth taking for the United States to say that if you are inviting a wanted war criminal, we're not coming?
It's a stance that a president could take. I think the White House has said there will be no meeting between, he won't be in the same room, for instance, in terms of meeting President Trump. That's absolutely out of the question. But you could imagine a scenario where a Sudanese politician who is literally responsible for Darfur and is wanted by the ICC is, I think, a premise that could warrant Trump recusing himself from that particular speech, maybe as an excuse or perhaps heartfelt. It's very hard to say, but I actually think that would actually be warranted.
But at this late stage, you cannot. I mean, that would be an outright affront against his hosts. I cannot.
Are you having trouble over there imagining Donald Trump doing something surprising, outrageous, affronting, and unprecedented?
I'm as I say, I suppose maybe call me an idealist. I hope that there is some sense in the foreign policy. Of course, this trip is going to be very interesting. The other parts as well. He's attending the NATO,
Israel, Brussels,
NATO,
and Taormina,
Israel,
yes.
NATO summit, etc. Fascinating. He'll have to prove himself for the first time outside of his own country.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Linda Yu and Sebastian Borger. Coming up next, the UK's Conservative Party launched their manifesto, Hang On To Your Hat.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer, or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017.
head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Linda Yu and Sebastian Borger. Now, as might be expected from a governing party with a double-digit poll lead and a largely hapless opposition, Britain's ruling Conservative Party are doing their dogged best to render the country's present general election campaign as tedious as they can without actually causing voters to sleep through polling day. The launch of the Tories' manifesto today did not deviate significantly from this script. The Prime Minister, Theresa May, promised, and I quote, mainstream government that would deliver for a mainstream Britain. Linda, how excited are you by this promise?
I couldn't wait to read the 84 pages. It just was, you know, the highlight of my day. I think we've had days now of manifesto releases. But actually, there were a few significant things in the Tory manifesto, especially around Brexit, which is worth noting. So, for instance, the Tory manifesto states that they will pledge to take Britain out of not just the single market, but the customs union. And so this is a clear statement that Britain will just be Canada in the future. It'll just have a free trade agreement with the EU.
It hopes.
Yeah, eventually. And I think the other notable things is, well, the Fixed Term Parliament Act is out.
They can't really stand by that in the circumstances.
No, I was going to say, they might raise taxes. They've dropped the pledge to, which had in the previous manifesto, because, Andrew, we only had an election 2 years ago. That manifesto said no tax increases.
I remember it like it was 2 years ago. The trouble is, of course, Sebastian, we have had that referendum in between times, which rather upset apple cart, scattered pigeons, etc., etc., etc. The Tories ditching that promise not to raise taxes and national insurance, is that an implicit suggestion that the whole Brexit thing might get a bit rickety?
I think you're terribly cynical.
I am.
Seriously now. This is a very interesting manifesto of a prime minister who we all thought it was cautious and who has come out and looked at her poll leads and said, I can do things which this country needs and which my predecessor was not brave enough to do. Namely, I can take all the benefits away from a group of people who don't need them, elderly people. She's cutting down on the pension promises. She's cutting down that rich pensioners, of which there are millions in this country, get £300 thrown after them to heat their houses. She's getting much more important. She's for the first time now, for people who need care, in social care in their old age, and this is going to be a growing problem in this country as in any other industrial
aging population,
that the house that people own is included in their assets up to the
£100,000,
which of course is nothing in the southeast of this country, particularly in London. I'm not a fan of Theresa May, but she has seen the Labour Party lurch to the left. She has seen UKIP disappear, and what she does is she drags her own party into the centre ground. She is the Tony Blair of 2017.
She may be on course to win that big a margin, but Linda, there's an Ipsos poll out today suggesting an 8-point bump for Labour. They are, of course, still 15 points down, and they are absolutely nowhere where questions of leadership are polled. But is there the remotest chance that the Conservatives, I think you can call it complacency in this election, might come back to bite them a bit?
I think that's why they're pitching this election as being much closer than it actually might be, according to the
polls. Well, you always do that.
So, yeah. Well, you need people to come out to vote. So I think the shy Tory vote in 2015 probably made the difference in terms of people actually not saying they would vote Tory. And then when the turnout came, they in the polling booth, they gave David Cameron a majority when he had actually expected, well, to be ruling in a coalition. So
indeed,
actually, I think they need to get the vote out. Labour's manifesto is actually much farther left than perhaps anything we've seen recently, so rail
certainly
nationalization.
Certainly since 1983, I think.
Indeed. And so I think in that sense, almost anything the Tories put out would be much more central. And in fact, since I would say David Cameron, they've occupied the central ground, you know, fairly well. And in fact, one of Labour's problems is that they're too similar to the Tories. That's no longer the case. That might explain the slight bump, because there will be those who are supportive of a much more... I say left, but essentially it's a much more socialist, in a sense, manifesto. But what Theresa
Northern
May is
European
doing, so.
Social Democrats.
Yeah, exactly.
Not
that's why.
More than that.
Yeah, exactly.
More than that.
I don't actually like labels too much because the modern iterations are so different than what we would normally think. But I think it's fair to say Theresa May is more on the, she is more in the center ground than Labour. And I think a few other things in the manifesto, which is actually worth, again, considering, is that she has essentially ditched the fiscal sustainability rules. The budget won't be balanced until 2025. They're pledging a lot more in terms of investment. As Sebastian said, she's abandoning the triple lock on pension increases after 2020, after which it'll rise by either wages or inflation. So these are things which are fiscally prudent, while at the same time, she's making a bigger pitch for social solidarity, worker representation on boards. It's actually things that she's actually said before. But I suppose if you are a little bit skeptical about whether politicians can deliver that, what they say, even in the manifesto, may not actually be what they do. And I think worker representation is actually an example of that. But there's no question to me, she has occupied the center ground. And in all elections, party members tend to favor what differentiates their parties. And in the general election, they tend to move towards the middle. And I think that's exactly why she's occupying this particular space. And she doesn't have a far-right party really challenging her at the moment, whereas Labour still has the Lib Dems. Remember the Lib Dem manifesto, which came out, which promised a second referendum on Brexit.
Well, it's something to look forward to next year. Yeah. keeping up the
every
record.
Year. Next year's the Scottish referendum. That's that also next? Possible.
Well,
so the EU referendum
much.
Would be the next year.
they become an annual event. We should move on finally tonight. If you have been at any point in the last couple of decades a passenger on a Fokker 70 operated by KLM, Cityhopper or Martinair, there is a decent chance, it turns out, that you were flown by royalty. King Willem Alexander of the Netherlands has revealed that he has been in the regular habit of serving as co-pilot on commercial flights, roughly twice a month on average. And as the Fokker 70s are being phased out, he plans to retrain on Boeing 737. Sebastian, would you have recognised him? This is where I always think about Dutch royalty. They've got it absolutely licked, haven't they? They have all the wealth and privilege attendant upon their position. And yet, I honestly, you could be crown prince for all I would know.
Indeed. I have to say, I'm still, he's been the king for a while now, hasn't he? Because his mother did what his grandmother and his great-grandmother did, namely abdicate at a reasonable age, quite different from some other queens I could think of.
Careful now.
No, I can't envisage his face, I would not have recognized him. But in the end, all the KLM flights I remember have been reasonably okay, so I don't mind.
Yeah, I think like a lot of people, I've been trying to recall KLM flights in which potentially the king might have been at the controls. Linda, would you have spotted him? Or do you think KLM could have charged extra? Should they have been making more of a thing of this?
I think I've actually taken the Cityhopper flight, but I don't think I have any opinion either way whether or not a king was actually flying my plane. I would like to think that means that extra security checks were taken about the plane and all the things that reassure me because the king was flying it. So that's essentially what I'm going to go with. But in general,
passengers had to sing the Dutch national anthem.
See, I always get really nervous if I notice somebody famous on the plane. I have this morbid terror of being listed as also among the dead.
Oh, I see. Oh,
well, right. Actually, what I like about the Dutch royals is that they essentially don't have, they have pretty middle-class lives, I guess. You know, like another Scandinavian royal I was at a conference with, which was the Norwegian crown prince. And I must say, they really could be just like your neighbor. It's very different than royals in some countries.
We will have to leave it there, unfortunately. The clock has beaten us, Linda Yu and Sebastian Borgert. Thank you both very much for joining us. That is all for today's Midori House. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jimena Minan Vega. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next at 1900, The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.